Hello and welcome to the Local and Global Social Justice Movements, part of the Equality Then and Now series hosted by the Federation's Equity Issues Portfolio at the Congress of Social Sciences and Humanities at Concordia University in Montreal. Please enjoy.
Okay, I will get started. So good morning and a warm Montreal welcome to the Canadian Federation for the Humanities and Social Sciences Equity Issue Portfolio, Equality Then and Now, the Status of Women 40 Years After the Byrd Commission series. My name is Melinda Smith, and I'm the Vice President Equity for the Canadian Federation. Thank you for coming to our second session on the local and global social justice movements. Yesterday, we had our first session on the gender wage gap, pay equity across four different provinces. Before I make a few comments, I also want to thank Concordia University for hosting the 79th Congress and the Mohawk people on whose territory we are visiting for their hospitality. This panel on local and global social justice movement, as I said, is one in a series of four, which will, along with a keynote by Donna Brazil on Wednesday, are being held to mark the 40th anniversary of the Royal Commission on the Status of Women. These sessions are being recorded, and the podcasts, along with the papers, will be posted to the Federation's Equity Matters blog. If you have not visited that site, please do visit it, and you can just Google Federation Equity Matters. On that blog, there's a whole series of commentaries on the Royal Commission, but also equity in the Academy in Canada. It's about 50 different commentaries since about January. A word about the Royal Commission on the Status of Women or the Byrd Commission. The establishment of the commission highlighted the important power of activism and engagement of NGOs with each other and with the state to effect social change. The Royal Commission was established through an activist campaign that included over 30 women's groups, and the Lester B. Pearson government responded to that advocacy on the 16th of February, 1967 by establishing the commission. And the commission was tasked to inquire into and report upon the status of women in Canada, to ensure for women equal opportunities with men in all aspects of Canadian society. After 6 months of hearings across Canada, the commission made some 167 recommendations, including in areas such as maternity leave, daycare, birth control and reproductive rights, pension reform, access to education, need for women to hold managerial positions, the Indian Act, and many more. The report was tabled in the House of Commons on the 7th of December, 1970. The priorities established by the Byrd Commission have since shaped the women's movements and many other social justice activist movements, and have framed the status of women as a fundamental social policy and social justice issue for Canada. At this Congress, we felt it was appropriate to use the occasion of the anniversary to offer a retrospective on the Byrd Commission and take stock of the status of women in Canada 40 years on, asking the following question: where do we go from here? But in order to address this question, we actually need to know, where are we, or from whence do we speak? This moment is also significant because it's the 25th anniversary of Section 15 of the Charter. It's the 25th anniversary of LEAF. It's the 25th anniversary of the Disabled Women's Network, the only national network dealing with disabled women and girls. And it's the 20th anniversary of the OCA crisis. So if you're asking the question, where are we, part of the response to that question is a political environment in which the word equality has been removed, for example, from the Status of Women's mandate. Many of the regional offices close, and many of the equality-seeking groups across Canada find themselves challenged by a climate which suggests we are all equal now. So when we say we are all equal now, the question is, who are the we that are equal? Mm-hmm. This is what our panelists are tasked with responding to. So without further ado, I would like to introduce you to our panelists. And they will go in this order. First, I will introduce you to the topics they will be speaking on, and then I will each introduce each panelist as they come up to the podium. The first presenter is Dr. Janine Brody, who will be presenting on the problem that has no name, Canada's Royal Commission on the Status of Women 40 years on. Professor Brody is a professor of political science and a Canada research chair in political economy and social governance at the University of Alberta, where she served as chair of the political science department from 1997 to 2003. She was elected as a fellow of the Royal Society of Canada in 2002 and currently serves as the director of the Royal Society's Academy 2 Division 1 for social sciences. Before joining the University of Alberta in 1996, she was a professor of political science at York University, where she also served as faculty fellow of the Institute for Social Research, inaugural director of the York Center for Feminist Research, and the John Robarts Chair in Canadian Studies. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Janine Brody.
To be here. And Melinda's given us 10 minutes, and she's fairly serious about that, so I will begin. 40th anniversary of the Royal Commission on the Status of Women, I think, is a bittersweet moment, particularly, I think, for women of my generation, white middle-class baby boomers. The Royal Commission, for them, I think, and the vibrant feminist activism that it cultivated fundamentally transformed our identities and our life courses. And I speak from a position of privilege here. The framers of the Royal Commission would undoubtedly reel at the silencing, hostility, and reversals that now characterize the gender equality agenda that they launched 40 years ago. But I think they would be, and we should be, equally concerned about the recent and sustained attack on the very idea of equality as a goal of political activism and as a critical indicator of political accountability. We need only pick up a newspaper, in fact, look at the FedCan Equity Matters blog, to appreciate the many ways in which equality politics is being trampled and silenced. Although this has been a long and insidious process, the campaign has intensified in recent years, indeed in recent months. Since the election of the minority Harper government, Canadians have been told in one way or another that gender equality has been achieved, or that the task of eliminating social inequalities is no longer affordable in an era of financial uncertainty and predatory globalization. To quote Bev Oda, the first in a revolving door of Harper's ministers responsible for the status of women, "This government does fundamentally believe that all women are equal. Every part of the federal government," she continued, "is responsible for programs to address the needs of both men and women." Thus, in 2006, the word equality was purged from the Status of Women mandate and website. Its independent policy program and regional offices were closed, and the Court Challenges program was canceled. Next on the agenda was the defunding of equity groups, which have been so critical in naming and making equality claims over the course of two generations. The list is so long. NAC, NARL, CREA, CIRA, APHIS, MATCH, AOTH. This concerted campaign to silence NGOs that dare name social inequality or demand redress now reaches well beyond the institutional traces of the women's movement. This winter, for example, the federal government closed the Canadian Human Rights Commission offices in Vancouver, Toronto, and Halifax, where the vast majority of racialized Canadians and recent immigrants live, and where 70% of all signed complaints to the commission were issued in 2008. Now, these aren't examples of fiscal restraint or the disciplining of so-called special interests. They announced that equity claims making is no longer considered a legitimate aspiration for Canadian citizens or their governments. It is, in effect, a declaration of indifference to the violence of social inequality, which, if met with silence and without solidarity, diminishes us all. All
modern structures of inequality, sexism, racism, colonialism, ability, sexuality, have their own long histories, but they are also strongly influenced by prevailing governing paradigms, powerful political idioms that help shape how we see and name social problems, as well as we consider them matters of private or public responsibility. Governing philosophies privilege particular vocabularies, styles of truth-telling, and truth-tellers. They also, however, give a language for claims-making and political engagement. The Royal Commission, in this sense, was a reaction to and a product of the idioms of post-war social liberalism. It arose, as Melinda said, in response to campaigning by a variety of women, mostly white middle-class women, who demanded that the federal government both identify and act upon what American feminist Betty Friedan at the time called a problem with no name. The problem for them was that although post-war discourses promised citizenship, equality, and social rights for all, women had been written out of this script as dependent and gendered. They were, of course, the revered linchpins of the male breadwinner model of social reproduction, but nonetheless second-class citizens, disciplined and constrained by sexual discrimination in the law, the labor force, the economy, the public sphere, and in the home. The problem was given a name within the context of Canada's governing paradigm in the post-war period: equality of opportunity. Thus, in 1966, the Pearson government appointed Florence Byrd to head a royal commission and assigned it with the mandate to recommend what steps might be taken by the federal government to ensure women equal opportunities with men in all aspects of Canadian society. It reported in 1970 with 167 recommendations. And a robust women's movement advanced the agenda forward, achieving, among other things, legal equality for women in the charter, legal abortion, pay equity, employment equity, stronger rape laws, and a national network of shelters for women. Judy Rebick has recently wrote that with the exception of a national daycare program, we achieved and surpassed the recommendations of the Royal Commission. At the time, and more so later, the Royal Commission was justifiably criticized, first, for sitting too comfortably with a liberal equality of opportunity framework, which advanced the normative, white, middle-class, heterosexual woman as the privileged subject of gender equality. And second, for trusting that the deeply entrenched and resilient hierarchies of exclusion in Canada, rooted in colonialism and racism, for example, could be so easily addressed through legislation. Absolutely right on both counts. But the Canadian experience also demonstrates that the dominant political discourses also create spaces of friction, possibility, and resistance. Social liberalism's promise of citizen equality, the expectation of state intervention to correct for systemic inequalities, and its commitment to social justice provided a language for this systemically disadvantaged to talk back to the state, to make claims as citizens who had been denied the promise of equality, redress, and progress. Thus, despite the omissions and exclusions, the new politics set in motion an unfolding practice of imminent critique. As Yuval Davis argues, it was a moral and political lever that was used by a variety of social movements of the excluded. Was perhaps the very success of the women's movement that put it in the neoliberals' crosshairs, first in line for a politics of delegitimization, dismantling, and disappearance. The women's movement was denigrated for being a special interest, unrepresentative of the real women in Canada. An elaborate gender institutional infrastructure, both inside and outside the state, was dismantled. And women were erased as a relevant social category, both in political discourse and public policy. But as I discussed earlier, having leveled the traces of the women's movement, this dismantling process has turned to all social justice organizations and equity projects. In their place, we're lathered with a different kind of equity talk. When Bev Oda told us that we're all equal now, she was rehearsing a central tenet in the new governing order, that we're all disembodied individuals, 21st century renditions of self-interested economic man, and the authors of our own history. This is individualization, a critical neoliberal governing instrument which effectively downloads responsibility for systemic factors such as financial meltdowns, deindustrialization, colonialism, racism, the disappearance of the family wage, onto individuals and their families. It is a governing strategy that demands that people find personal causes and responses to what Beck calls, biographic solutions that are, in effect, the shared social challenges of a globalizing era. This governing strategy demands that we take responsibility for and contrive our own solutions to our own problems, our own circumstances. For example, how to balance childcare, elder care, and full-time employment. The problem with this formulation is not that individuals and families do not try to find solution to their particular problems or try to comply with the individualized solutions when they're forced upon them. Canadians struggle daily to try to meet these constraints and expectations. Rather, the problem, as Bauman argues, is that the very formulation of a biographic solution to a systemic contradiction is an oxymoron. It may be sought, but it never can be found. Our individuality consists of being confined to individual resources and individual responsibilities for life choices, none of which are a matter of choice. And we can go through the kind of mounting and breathtaking consequences of this governing strategy. Okay. I'll go through them rapidly. In 2004, Canada ranked 7th on the World Economic Forum Gender Equality Gap Index. Now it ranks 25th. Canada ranks dead last among 25 OECD countries in terms of early childhood education. The United Nations recently called on Ottawa to stop the growing disparities between minority groups and their mainstream counterparts in all aspects of Canadian life. Canada has changed a great deal since the Royal Commission on the Status of Women gave its report in 1970. Its vision of gender equality no longer grasps, indeed cannot meaningfully see, the social changes that lie before us. But above and beyond its legislative accomplishments and shortcomings, I think it taught us two valuable lessons. How we name social problems is important, and who does the naming matters a great deal. Although the prevailing government paradigm tells us we're all equal individuals now, the structural underpinnings of inequality have not been disappeared through the politics of naming. In fact, as income gaps grow, as Indigenous women, women of color, and immigrant women endure the weight of social exclusion, as the iconic subjects of this new governing order, families with choice, struggle to balance work-life commitments and family budgets. It's increasingly apparent to us all that neoliberalism's expectation of self-sufficiency is an impossible construct. Inequalities may no longer be rendered visible through the lens of social liberalism, but indeed they cannot be elided through the conceits of neoliberalism either. So, to conclude, social groups have begun to name these mounting social inequalities, and I think that Aziz is going to talk about this. I would simply conclude by saying that, like those early campaigners for the Royal Commission, it's our turn to name these problems for what they are: indicators of a failed experiment in governance, a calculated assault on social equity, and a reckless gamble with our collective future. Thank you.
Our second presenter is Aziz Chowdhury, who will be speaking on the topic, Learning from the Struggle, Challenging NGOization and the Professionalization of Social Change. Aziz Chowdhury is an assistant professor in the Department of Integrated Studies and Education at McGill University. His areas of research and teaching include popular education, social movements, social justice, and social change. Dr. Chowdhury's current research focuses on learning and social action and knowledge production in activist social movement milieus. Please join me in welcoming Aziz Chowdhury.
Thanks, Melinda. I want to start by acknowledging the Indigenous people on whose territory that we're meeting this week. And thanks for organising this panel. I think it's a really good initiative, and I feel privileged to speak on this panel with Janine and Sunira and Garda. So my talk's going to draw on my academic work on knowledge, on learning, knowledge production and power in social movements, as well as over two decades of activist work in Aotearoa, New Zealand, the Asia-Pacific and North America, in various anti-colonial and anti-capitalist movements, which span from very localised struggles, localised anti-privatisation struggles, to Indigenous solidarity work, global justice work in relation to the World Trade Organisation and so on. And my current involvement here in Montreal on the board of the Immigrant Workers Centre here in Montreal. And just for a commercial break, if you're interested in the work of the Immigrant Workers Centre, the Fernwood Table has copies of a book that came out last year called Fight Back, Workplace Justice for Immigrants, and it documents, among other things, the struggles of domestic workers in Canada in relation to the very kind of exploitative conditions that many women from the Philippines primarily live and struggle and work in daily. So last year, Garda, Sunira, Melinda and I were involved in the 9th Critical Race and Anti-Colonial Studies Conference that was organised by Researchers and Academics of Colour for Equity. And the subtitle of that conference was the Politics, Cultures and Economies of Doing Good. And related to the theme of questioning the good of doing good, if you like, the past decades have seen the ascendancy, the arise, if you like, of non-governmental organisations at a local and at a global level, and a widespread sort of celebration and valorisation of terms like civil society. And I think it's interesting listening to what Janine was talking about this whole way in which capitalist relations in the present phase of capitalism under neoliberalism, whatever names you want to call it, has, you know, this intrinsic idea of wanting to download responsibility and to individualise responsibility for all kinds of things onto communities, particularly onto women. And then to think about the way in which non-governmental organisations, both here and internationally, play a role in that downloading, and to think about the way in which often those organisations end up being very dependent on funding, on other forms of support from states, and end up in some ways being very kind of congruent with a neoliberal agenda. Alongside then this sort of celebration and triumphalist writing about NGOs, there have been a lot of critiques of NGOs, and the term NGOization has come out. And a lot of feminist, Marxist, critical race and other critical scholars, including people like Sonia Alvarez, who's written about the Latin American feminist NGO boom, Isla Jard's excellent work on Palestine and on the work of the NGOization, co-optation and undermining of the women's movement there in the post-Oslo period, where she, for example, talks about professionalisation being something that produces upward rather than downward accountability, exclusion rather than inclusion. Shahzad Mojab has written work on women's NGOs recently in Iraqi Kurdistan, looking at the foreign funding of women NGOs in creating new political economic elites, depoliticising the women's movement and further marginalising the poor. Sangeeta Kamat also has done interesting work looking at NGOisation and the growth of NGOs on political space more generally and on development in India and internationally. And also Andrea Smith and Insight Women of Colour Against Violence, who put out a very interesting collection about 3 years ago called The Revolution Will Not Be Funded Beyond the Non-Profit Industrial Complex, looked at North America, Latin America in relation to some of these trends. And the question here is, what happens to movements when NGOs become sort of the representatives of the people? That's one of the major questions. And the professionalisation of community-based NGOs and their depoliticization works really well for neoliberal regimes, keeping existing power structures, arguably, vis-a-vis the distribution of society's resources intact, while promoting a kind of degree and a local form sometimes of change and development. My own work, such as a chapter in a book that's coming out in September called Learning from the Ground Up, Global Perspectives on Social Movements and Knowledge Production, looks at how within supposedly alternative global justice networks, a relatively small NGO elite attempts to claim positional superiority for forms of professionalised knowledge and advocacy that attempt to sideline, filter, or erase more critical positions opposed to capitalism and colonialism. I contend that the dominant tendency of NGOs to compartmentalise the world into issues and projects, and their unwillingness to name or confront processes like capitalism and colonialism, a kind of what I call an ideology of pragmatism, where it's always about just making a few changes here and there rather than actually really looking at a systemic change that would require some mass building of counterpower to states and capital alike. And this peculiar kind of, or perhaps not so peculiar kind of colonial amnesia which prevails in countries like Canada, New Zealand and Australia, which is often running through many quote-unquote progressive organisations when they put forwards to the neoliberal agenda, which essentially erases the history of colonial injustice and the struggles and resistance of Indigenous peoples in these lands, I think are characteristics of these kinds of problems. So too, the erasure, when we talk about things like civil society, I never understand who exactly is in and who's out of civil society, right? You know, does civil society include everybody? Does it include people of colour? Does it include Indigenous peoples? Or does it only include professionalised NGOs, etc.? And I think it's really important, though, you know, not to dwell solely on the negative, but to think about ways in which this process is actually being challenged by those struggles, by women of colour and Indigenous women, particularly in Canada here, for example, the key roles that have been played in countless independence movements around the world, the everyday resistance of people who are doing the invisible or visible work, migrant workers, non-status women working in these cities. And if we trace the lineage of this critique of NGOism, I think it takes us back, the scholarly critiques, I think it takes us back to acknowledging a debt to collective forms of critical knowledge production, learning and debates that have come out of movements, that have come out of people who are engaged in daily struggles. And I think one of the things that often we overlook in thinking about struggles and thinking about movements is that intellectual work, is those conceptual resources that I think are tools with which we can actually start to think through a bit more creatively about how to resist and how we're able to, as academics, as people in these institutions, play some kinds of roles in this resistance. Rahila Gupta, who's with South All Black Sisters in the UK, says that it's not easy for activists to sit down and record their work, but in the age of information overload, you need to record in order almost to prove that you exist. So how do we, as critically engaged scholars, avoid replicating a tendency to ignore or misconstrue forms of social action that don't fit within a pre-established theoretical framework? There's a danger... How am I doing for time, Melinda? Oh, yeah, fine. No worries. There is a danger that the conventional processes of production of academic scholarship and assumptions or claims that such activity constitutes some kind of apex of intellectual rigour and inquiry can in fact overlook the complexities and dynamics of activism and the intellectual contributions of activist practice. I'm not saying here that we romanticise activist knowledges. I'm not saying here that all knowledge that is produced in struggle is somehow progressive and good. But I am saying that I think that there are some interesting things to think about when we think about things like even, you know, the history of the Byrd Commission. We think back into other sort of processes and we think about those all kinds of levels of mass mobilisation and organising that take place and what remains visible and what remains invisible. And we think about similar things that are taking place today. We need movements to create counterpower and radical alternatives to what's going on in the world today. And I think that we need to look beyond existing critiques of NGOisation drawing on those resources that are produced in struggle. And I think academic work on activism and social movements requires some level of clear political investment on our part as scholars, repaying intellectual debts that many of us have to those conversations and debates and discussions and dilemmas in the everyday worlds of organising for social change. And reconnecting with ideas and action is an important thing that I think we need to think about. If we're to play a role in creating a future in a world marked by devastating economic and ecological crises, militarised violence, and I'll point out today that there are 14 to 20 people that are thought to be killed by Israeli forces on a flotilla of boats that is trying to get humanitarian aid into Palestine, then if we think about the war and occupations that are going on, that Canada is also complicit in, we need to be serious about thinking about building social movements. The theme of this year's Congress is Connected Understandings. Perhaps one of the most important challenges for those of us who are privileged to work in academia and are committed to social justice is to connect, to reconnect, renew and ground our scholarly work with continuing struggles here in Canada and around the world. In doing so, I think it would be helpful to think about the relationship between building counterpower in mass social movement mobilisations and how we understand and confront state power in all of its forms and capital at local and global levels, at the same time as we think critically and, I would argue, guard against processes of demobilisation, depoliticisation and the disciplining of dissent that is often, I would argue, part and parcel of this kind of professionalisation and NGOisation of social change. And thank you. I hope I stayed within my time, Melinda.
Our third presenter is Gara Marus, who will be speaking on the topic Equity Then and Now, the Anti-Racist Challenge to Liberal Feminism. She is an assistant professor in the Simone de Beauvoir Institute at Concordia University. Prior to joining Concordia, she held a Shirk postdoctoral fellowship in the Department of Sociology and Anthropology at Carleton University in Ottawa. Her doctoral research explored anti-racist challenges to transnational solidarity movements, and her research interests include critical race, post-colonial, gender and cultural studies, and feminism. Please join me in welcoming Gara Marus.
I too would like to begin by sincerely thanking Melinda Smith for bringing us together for this panel. For my presentation, I hope to invite some critical reflection on how gendered and racialized differences are often understood and dealt with within state-sponsored commissions such as the Royal Commission on the Status of Women. Specifically, I want to share with you what stands out for me about the Royal Commission on the Status of Women, given my work on the 2007-2008 province-wide Government Consultation Commission in the province of Quebec, commonly known as the Bouchard-Taylor or Reasonable Accommodation Commission. My aim is to offer some critical reflections on the status of differently racialized groups of women in Canada, both then and now, by looking at some of the features of the two commissions side by side. I also want to propose that while we need to acknowledge some of the positive effects that have come about from both of these commissions, it is just as important to pay close attention to how, paradoxically, some women's rights are either disregarded or curtailed in the name of feminism in both of them. I should admit that until I was asked to be on this panel, I had not spent much time thinking about the Royal Commission, since my work focuses more on very contemporary social justice movements. So some of you will likely know more about it than I do. However, in preparation for today, I did skim through the final report of the Royal Commission that came out in 1970, and I was immediately struck by two things in it that are very curious to me in light of the more recent Bouchard-Taylor Commission in Quebec. The first thing that is noteworthy for those of us who are concerned with questions of race are the blatant exclusions that are inherent in it. Although there are two categories of non-white women that are invoked, immigrant women and Native women, it is really indisputable that the woman who is imagined to be at the heart of this commission is white. So in other words, women of color and indigenous women are really figures that hover on the margins of this Royal Commission. The second thing that jumps off the pages of the Royal Commission report, and this is arguably also one of its greatest successes, is how committed it was to ensuring women's economic independence and equality of opportunity. The framework that the Royal Commission operated out of was based on a very straightforward liberal feminist logic. Since gender differences are not based in biology, and since men and women share a common humanity, women should have the same legal rights and educational and work opportunities as men do. So to this end, many of the recommendations that the Commission concluded with focused on demands for equal pay for work of equal value, educational opportunities, and women's access to managerial and political positions, and their participation in public life. And as a result of this important commission, we now have government agencies and organizations that have been set up to monitor and ensure that women's rights are upheld. Moving into the present day, it is quite fascinating to consider how questions of women's rights, and especially economic independence and access to public life, have been playing out in very contradictory ways in Quebec around the Bouchard-Taylor Commission. Before I outline some of those features of the Bouchard-Taylor Commission to explain what I mean, I would like to ask you to bear in mind that in focusing on Quebec, I do not at all mean to imply that the situation is more serious here or worse than anywhere else, or anywhere else in Canada. The Bouchard-Taylor Commission really just serves as a convenient case study for me to talk about a much larger trend taking place in many parts of the Western world. Also, please bear in mind that in 10 minutes total, I, of course, cannot address the time and space-specific details that that commission was embedded in, including things like the articulation of a fragile national identity under threat, the emphasis on secularism, and so on. For those who are interested in those aspects, I have an article coming out next month that examines those things in details that I'd be happy to share with you. But for the purposes of today's panel, I will only very briefly sketch out two aspects of the Bouchard-Taylor Commission that tie to the earlier points I raised about the Royal Commission on the Status of Women. The first point is that although the Bouchard-Taylor Commission was not explicitly about women, like the Royal Commission was, it was mobilized almost entirely around questions of women's rights. Yet, what is interesting is that in the Bouchard-Taylor Commission, instead of focusing almost exclusively on white women, as the earlier commission did, this time it's the figure of the Muslim woman that is front and center. In fact, the figure of the Muslim woman is what sparked the whole reasonable accommodation debate in the first place, when the people of a small town named Hérouville infamously declared, among other things, that they will not tolerate women being stoned, mutilated, or burned in their town. And in recent years, randomly flipping through media reports on gender equality in Canada reveals most obviously that the concern now is very much focused, very specifically, not only on the Muslim woman, but the veiled Muslim woman. Indeed, we're so preoccupied with this figure that we are regularly invited to contemplate what type of veil she should be allowed to wear, whether she should be allowed to vote or even play soccer while veiled, and so on. So that the white woman of the earlier commission has been replaced in recent years by Muslim women is noteworthy to me and can imply that the first group has achieved equality and is now determined to save the second group. To put it differently, Muslim women's bodies have now become the battleground upon which we demarcate the lines between women's liberation and women's oppression in Canada. It's also important to notice that despite the fact that one of the key tenets of feminism is women's capacity to understand and articulate their experiences of oppression on their own terms, the figure of the veiled woman has conveniently served to position non-Muslim Quebecers as being more knowledgeable about the needs of Muslim women than Muslim women themselves. So the second related point, the contradiction I mentioned earlier, that is evident between the two commissions, pertains to economic and educational opportunity. Here, I want to show the paradox whereby some of the feminist groups and agencies that the Royal Commission on the Status of Women paved the way for are now using their positions of power to call for legislation that will restrict rather than enhance the rights of some women. Specifically, I'm referring to the recent Charest government announcement of Bill 94, an act that would prevent women wearing the niqab from accessing hospitals, schools, universities, and other public services. And this bill would ban women in niqab from working in the public sector. In a press conference, Premier Charest described the legislation as defending two principles, one being gender equality, and as stemming largely out of the efforts of a provincial feminist advisory group. So paradoxically, and owing largely to the very women's rights associations and organizations that the Royal Commission helped to create, the regulation of women's public expression and their denial to government services and public life is now being carried out in the name of feminism. So to conclude, as we reflect back on and celebrate how far we've come since the Royal Commission, I'd like to suggest that we need to consider how racialized exclusions continue to shape feminist interventions today. And although the Royal Commission on the Status of Women has been hailed as the first success of the second wave of Canadian feminism because it gave legitimacy to the rights of bodily and economic autonomy for women, this apparently still only applies to some women and not others. I'll stop there. Thank you very much.
Our fourth presenter is Professor Sunero Tobani, who will be speaking on the topic, The State of Canadian Feminism, Race, Indigeneity, and the Mainstream Women's Movement. Since her appointment at UBC's Center for Women and Gender Studies, Dr. Sunero Tobani has been committed to using an interdisciplinary approach in her teaching and research and to maintaining her involvement in community and social justice activities. Her research focuses on globalization, citizenship, migration, and race and gender relations. Dr. Tobani is also past president of the National Action Committee on the Status of Women, Canada's NAC, Canada's largest feminist organization. Please join me in welcoming to the podium.
Thank you very much. So I would also like to begin by acknowledging that we are on Indigenous land, and I would like to also thank Melinda very much for inviting me to be part of this panel. Before I begin my presentation, I want to kind of point out the obvious that as we carry out our deliberations in terms of how far women have come, this is a country that is today at war. and women are very centrally implicated in this war, that women are waging this war in Afghanistan, and that this has to be part of our equation when we think about how far women have come since the Royal Commission. So 40 years on, what can be said about the state of Canadian feminism? I'm referring to the state with a capital S in my talk and not a small s, because I want to talk this morning about the relationship between the state and Canadian feminism. I want to look at the state in Canadian feminism, and I want to look at Canadian feminism in the state. Okay? By Canadian feminism, I do not refer to all the various traditions of feminism, both theoretical and activist, within Canada, but by Canadian feminism, I'm referring to the mainstream Canadian feminism, which from my perspective has been deeply shaped by its own politics of the nation. Canadian feminism has been deeply shaped by state policies and practices, as many of the speakers before me have pointed out, and in many ways, mainstream feminist organizations have served, whether informally or otherwise, as organizations of the state. With very few exceptions, I would argue, they have reproduced the exclusionary racialized practices of the state within the terrain of feminist politics and in women's lives. And, you know, I mean, just such obvious theoretical references for making such an analysis of Canadian feminist organizations. The argument made by Althusser about ideological state apparatus would support such a reading, as would Roxana Ng's classic study, The Politics of Community Services, which demonstrated how feminist immigrant women's organizations, initially set up to serve the interests of immigrant women, ended up doing the work of the state through the politics of funding to produce immigrant women's labor as a cheapened commodity for the labor market. And of course, this is not even to mention Foucault's work on biopower and disciplinary practices of the state. In my own book, Exalted Subjects, I describe the imbrication of state practices through exaltation of nationality as a process within the very constitution of subjects who came to recognize and produce themselves as Canadian subjects. So those are the kind of theoretical grounds on which I would make a claim for the analysis that I'm forwarding this morning. So let's talk about the political context then, when the Royal Commission was appointed, and the political context now. Indigenous women and women of color have historically been differently and asymmetrically located within the Canadian nation state, that is, in relation to the state, to the nation of Canadians, and to their own respective, that is, Aboriginal and people of color communities. In the founding of the settler society, that is Canada, the racial and gendered politics of the state were organized through a complex triangulation of relations, with Indigenous peoples marked for physical and cultural extinction, seen as completely disposable, Euro-Canadians for integration into the nation, and people of color for perpetual outsider status as immigrants and today as newcomers. This history is complex but very well documented, and I will not go into greater detail about it. I will also not go into the details of how this pattern of racial politics has continued to shape processes of racialization and nationalization within the settler society after the development of the welfare state, with the consequence that not only were the experiences and interests of Indigenous women and women of color quite different from those of mainstream Canadian women, but also they have been conflictual. So here I will just note that the liberalization of immigration and citizenship policies during the 1960s and 70s, which is when the Royal Commission is appointed, allowed immigrants greater access to education, employment opportunities, and social services, but that this was also a moment that marked the beginning of the rise of the restructuring of the welfare state, ensuring that such gains would remain tenuous and limited at best. The adoption of multiculturalism as official state policy led to the culturalization of immigrant communities as culturally incommensurable with the nation, even if they could be tolerated, giving rise to what Himani Banerjee has described as a form of ethnic citizenship. Therefore, despite the liberalization of citizenship, which is part of the Royal Commission's kind of political work, the ongoing dispossession of Aboriginal peoples continues to remain the basis for the reproduction of the nation state, and the labor of immigrant women continues to remain indispensable to the workings of the national economy. The Royal Commission on the Status of Women undertook its mandate within these politics of nation and state formation, and in its definition of women, elevated gender to primacy, decoupling gender from the social relations of colonialism, race, class, disability, sexuality, as many of the other speakers this morning have also pointed out. If Western feminism had defined the white middle-class heterosexual woman as the real subject of feminism, in the Royal Commission, the state also was defining the Euro-Canadian white middle-class heterosexual woman as the real subject of the Royal Commission's mandate. One of my early experiences with this fraught politics of nation, race, gender, aboriginality at the national level occurred soon after I was elected on the board of the National Action Committee on the Status of Women. And this experience, a very important learning experience in my own work as an activist scholar, and has shaped it very significantly since then, was the feminist organizing that took place in the early 1990s with regard to the Charlottetown Accord. And I will use this example to demonstrate the kind of political claims that I'm making about Canadian feminism and the state. In 1992, under the Conservative government of Brian Mulroney, the federal and provincial governments negotiated a package of constitutional amendments that would change the Constitution of Canada. Many of you in this room must be familiar with this history, and I'm going to do a very quick, crude, and dirty kind of summary of that and that political moment, because, you know, I don't have time to go into the details here. Do I have some time? Okay, so I will do this really quickly and really dirtily. Please excuse me for that. This package became known as the Charlottetown Accord and would have resulted in a wide-ranging devolution of powers to the provinces. It would have increased provincial powers over resources such as forestry, mining, and as well as over cultural policy, immigration policy, among many other areas. It would have limited the powers of the federal state to set conditions for the provinces in the areas of social services, immigration, and would have removed barriers to flows of goods, services, labor, capital across provinces. This accord was seen as a crucial piece by the feminist movement of the neoliberal restructuring of the Canadian economy. It would have greatly, as I said, weakened federal powers in many areas and opened the door to increased privatization and deregulation and the emergence of patchwork of social services and programs in contrast to the national standards for these programs across the country. The accord recognized the principle of Aboriginal self-government, but not self-determination. A very, very important distinction here, and had also in it a Canada clause to define the character of the country, and this exercised feminist interest because, you know, gender equity was something that feminist organizations wanted to be part of this Canada clause amongst a host of other kind of equity recognitions. Some Aboriginal groups, including the Assembly of First Nations, had been consulted in some fashion during this making of the Charlottetown Accord, but the Native Women's Association of Canada came out in opposition to the accord. They argued that Native women were not represented and they demanded a seat at the table, right? People remember this history? Native Women's Association came out very strongly and they launched a court challenge to stop the referendum on the Charlottetown Accord on the basis of the non-representation of Aboriginal women's issues and concerns by the Aboriginal groups that had been consulted and by the Canadian state largely. So this was the first feminist voice to come out and say, we oppose this and it is on this basis that we oppose it and we are going to stop this. A very, very, very clear and radical feminist analysis. NAAC at that time, of course, initially came out in support of the Native Women's Association of Canada, but in the ensuing political debate, emerged as the leading player, the leading and the only feminist voice. In all of the town halls that were organized, that were televised on CBC media coverage, NAC became the feminist voice on this issue. The Native Women's Association was completely marginalized, disappeared from the whole political discussion going on across the country. Immigrant women were excluded completely as not having any role or any say in it because we were the newcomers. We didn't understand the politics of the nation that really impacted feminism. Immigration was a marginal issue. The question of how these accords would impact the rights of immigrant women were never part of the public discussion, not even within NAC's organizing. And so what I want to argue is here we see a stark example of a leading feminist organization. Many of us have worked for this organization and put our activist energy in it, replicating exactly the same politics of the state as we have seen in the formation of the Canadian nation. That is, treating Aboriginal people as completely indispensable, even when they are the grounds for the radical feminist critique of this political position that the mainstream feminist movement then comes to own and adopt. Native women became completely dispensable, and immigrant women were seen as newcomers, hence not really understanding the importance of these constitutional rearrangements, and their issues did not come into the picture anyway. And so not only did this destroy in a crucial moment the possibility of a real radical alliance of women with different feminist perspectives along a whole range of issues to come together and organize as a challenge to the state, the Native Women's Association of course continued with their court challenge, which they lost. The referendum was of course organized, which got lost for a number of other reasons. It didn't pass. But what this did was it destroyed the possibility of a real alliance under Aboriginal women's feminist leadership, right, to contest the politics of the state. And it is on using this example, I was planning to use two more, but I don't have time. that I want to make an argument for us to pay attention to the state within feminist movements and feminist organizations and how feminism has reproduced the state in Canada in particular kinds of ways. And, you know, the war on terror, with the war having been defined as a feminist project, saving Afghan women, building schools to send little Afghan girls to get education, is a key part of the legitimacy of this war. And feminists, many feminist organizations have been in the front lines of waging this war. Thank you.
Okay, we have some time for questions. Please direct them to panelists on the engineering, Brody, Sunera Tabani, Aziz Chowdhury, and Gadam Arous. So, please. Okay. Go ahead.
I'm very confused because when I looked at the title of this, it said local and global justice issues. But it seems to me, judging from the three of the four speakers, that it really just boils down to one issue, women's issues. And I can't help wondering what happened. For example, I haven't heard the word trade union mentioned. I haven't heard the word globalization of mineral extraction and uses across the globe. I haven't heard any of those things. Working class, what happened to the working class? Or is the working class simply the women of the working class? And when I read through the program of the Congress, I had that same impression that we were dealing with global problems, but these problems ultimately boiled down to women, indigenous people, and so on. In other words, I'm probably being unduly harsh. The flavors of the month.
Let me partly respond to that. As the Vice President for Equity at the Canadian Federation for Humanities and Social Sciences, I organized a series of panels on for across Congress. And as part of that programming, we used the 40th anniversary of the Royal Commission on the Status of Women in order to raise, in order to look back as a retrospective. So that's I'll just deal with the programming for the on the Royal Commission. And I think it's, if you listen to the first, if you listen to our four presentations, I think it's fairly clear why we think it is important and relevant to raise those questions. My view is, I also heard in all of those presentations precisely what you're saying they didn't raise, which is the way in which these local struggles for equity are connected to activism at home and abroad. So that's part of what I heard, and I think that was part of the cross-cutting. As to the reference to the flavor of the month, when you're talking about a history, the long view of history, whether it's the short view of history, which is the 40th anniversary of the Royal Commission of the Status of Women, or the longer history of colonialism, I would be hard-pressed to say that's the flavor of the month, maybe the flavor of centuries. And so from my point of view, I think they suggest the questions raised by all of those historical experiences, and in particular the reports that people are referring to, still pertain today. So I will take responsibility for the organizing the sessions, which I think are important, and I think they will probably be important next year and for time to come. But I will let others speak to what I think their papers took up. But if there are others who want to speak to the issue of class or other dimensions of the struggle, that's important as well. Or we could take. Please speak into the microphones because it's being recorded for podcast.
I have a question about the engagement of youth on these issues, in particular reference to voting patterns, which we know from research that's been done has documented the decline in voting patterns of particularly 18 to 24-year-olds since the early 90s. And I wondered if you could comment on engagement of youth, because it's a pattern, excuse me, that's been for over a decade now of this decline. And other research says that people establish their voting patterns when they're young, too. So if you could talk about ways in which to engage youth in some of the issues that you've been presenting today.
I'll just very briefly start by just saying that a lot of the activism that is taking place around the commission that I was speaking about is very much youth inspired and youth motivated, and by youth I mean young women. A lot of the students at the institute where I work, undergrad students, were very much the ones, the driving force behind the interventions that have since been made to critique the situation. So there's, at that level, where I am at least, there is a really inspiring level of engagement with, political issues and social issues. As to, engagement with the actual voting, I can't reply to that.
Yeah, I'd like to say something about this. I think that, it's a very kind of complex question here around youth activism, because certainly, I think in the anti-war movement there are a lot of young women who are very active. If we look at the Palestinian solidarity movement across this country, we see the engagement. If we look at the environmental movement, the interesting thing is that a lot of women are not doing this as feminists. They're not doing it in the name of feminism. So that's an interesting thing to think about in terms of how we address this. One of the things that I teach is a practicum course where students are required to, engage in activism while they take the course. So, there are all kinds of initiatives like that I'm sure, some of us in this room are engaged in. But I think that this is a moment when, the kind of mainstream social movements are at the weakest ever, I think. And I don't know, Janine, you have a kind of longer view of this history in Canada, but I think that they're at the lowest ever, the weakest. And I think it's a moment that in which young people, there aren't kind of obvious directions in which to channel this activism. But I think it's clearly there, and there is a disillusionment with electoral politics, you know, not only amongst the youth, but even, you know, with NAC, for example. Like Charlottetown for me was really important because we saw the limits of electoral politics and working within that kind of political paradigm, because, you know, the Charlottetown Accord was defeated, the referendum, you know, was resoundingly no was the vote across the country, but all of those amendments, you know, have gone through anyway, right? And so you kind of, you know, and then we look at what has happened to social democratic parties, and you know, you kind of, we've hit the limits, right, in terms of politically. And I think that does have it's a moment when it is very, there is no obvious kind of direction in which to be channeling these politics. And then the movements that are growing strong and that are kind of gaining ground are demonized in the mainstream, right? As radical, over the top, you know, the kind of attacks that we see on Palestinian solidarity organizing across this country, so they also become a place which are not valorized, like, you know, trade unions or, you know, come to your nearest women's center, right? It's a different kind of moment, I think, in that organizing.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Sanera, just maybe a couple of points. About 2 months ago, I picked up the newspaper, and there was a little, you know, study. And it said that young women in Canada believed that they could do anything, all right? And then I read further down, 80% of them wanted to be actresses. So one of the points that I want to make there is that effectively, you know, there has been this course, this discourse of individualization and genderlessness and so on. I mean, you know, those young girls will soon discover that they make 70% of the wage of their male counterparts, and, you know, this involves some acting, but probably not getting paid for it. And the other point is about political parties. I mean, if we simply look at the political system, when we reflect back, for example, on, you know, the high points of engagement around the 80-84 election and so on, it was because there's a dual process happening in an election. You speak to constituencies, then they identify. And so the political parties were speaking to women as a constituency. The broader malaise in the federal party system, which we seem to, like, rehearse again and again, like Groundhog Day, is that all of the parties are speaking to so-called voter self-interest, individuals' voter self-interest. And so it then becomes, you know, who gives me the bigger tax break? And then quite a bit of bitterness when we find out that they were lying. Mm.
Other questions?
Please. I apologize for making a poor choice of seating. I was far away from the microphone. When one reads the report of the Royal Commission, it becomes very clear that in addition to equal opportunity and legal status issues that predominated, there's also a significant chapter relating to reproductive health and the women's place in the family. And I did not hear any of you explicitly addressing that portion of the commission's report. So I was wondering if you panelists could comment at all on what you see as the status of the women's health movement, both in terms of reproductive health and in terms of other health and in terms of the issues regarding women and the family. Thank you.
I'll speak very briefly, and then maybe one of the other panelists will want to take this up. And I think that, you know, one of the other kinds of lessons of the Royal Commission and if you like, the second wave of the women's movement or social justice or equity movements generally, is that things are never won, that things are always a matter of struggle. I was just saying to Sanera, recently that the federal government is no longer going to fund Planned Parenthood, either in Canada or internationally. That's scandalous. And so I think that in terms of access to abortion, for example, has been in quite precipitous decline really since the 1990s. We have the legal right, but there are no doctors in, for example, the Maritime Provinces or so on. Hospital beds are being cut and et cetera. So broadly speaking, the kind of negative indicators that I was pointing to also apply to women's health.
I agree. I think they really apply to women's health, and this is a government that's particularly hostile. And, you know, I think there is a session that has been organized that feminists are going to be looking at the new kind of defunding that's taking place, not only in Canada, but also at the international level, the position that's been taken by the Canadian government. So there is going to be an emergency session where feminists are kind of going to get together to strategize about how to respond to this new state of affairs.
I was really interested by the argument that a number of you are making, that feminist issues become the pretense for activities that actually disadvantage women. And I just wanted to make an observation that women have worn clothing that covered their entire bodies for religious reasons for many, many centuries. Roman Catholic nuns have never been attacked for wearing that kind of clothing. So this question is really by way of asking Sunera Thavani to say a little more about the global social justice issue that concerns Canadians, and that is the war, and to ask you, what do you think? I mean, the mess has been created now, and certainly the war wasn't being fought, never has been fought. Really, to save the women in Afghanistan. We all remember that email that circulated for several years, and it wasn't until 9/11 that the war, that we became involved. So, but now that we have this mess, what, you know, do you have any ideas about, or any of you have any ideas about what you think Canada should be doing?
Okay, so you know, I think that I've kind of the position I would take about what Canada should be doing is take the troops out in the war. There's clear that there is no way out of this mess without a negotiated settlement. Disengage from supporting U.S. foreign policy. I mean, you know, it's a whole lot of things, but immediately get the troops out in the war. This has to be like a political demand of the, I've argued for a long time, the women's movement in this country. But, you know, I don't think about the kind of the way in which the state has worked on gender as using it as a pretense. I don't, you know, there are a lot of feminists who are talking about the Bush administration having hijacked feminism. I don't actually see that as a pretense. I don't see that as a hijacking of feminism. I see it as the logic of a particular kind of feminism. That and I think that it advances women's rights. And if we look at the war on terror, this is a historically unprecedented level of women's participation, right? Not just in the military, but all the other kind of related industries that are tied to this war. If we look at media, journalism, access to publication, walk into any bookstore, you know, and you will see that the 10 best books will be about veiled Muslim women, or what's wrong with Islam, or how to understand the pathology of Muslim men, right? So it has, I don't see this as just a pretense. I think that it actually opens doors for women, and it gives them a real stake in a particular kind of politics, in a particular kind of, you know, feminist politics. So I don't actually see it as pretense or a hijacking of feminism in any way. I think the war has presented tremendous opportunities to women and feminism, and I think that's the basis on which they have made a stronger alliance with the state. And I think that in the long run, it's going to be, you know, obviously from my perspective, highly damaging, not just for Muslim women, but, you know, for Canadian women, for example. To, you know, we still have women in the front line of upholding this this view of the war in Afghanistan as having been kind of, you know, the lesser of two evils. We still continue to have that kind of feminist defense of it. And the reason I don't say that the Bush administration hijacked this politics is because, you know, there was no shortage of feminists who endorsed that view, who upheld it, who gave it credibility, who gave it legitimacy, right? And in this, that kind of relationship that I describe as exaltation, you know, is part of state formation, because states are not something that just coming into being, and that's all they are. And this is an incredible moment for state and nation formation in a way that is really integrating gender at a level that I don't think we've seen before. So, you know, I have a kind of different understanding of how these processes and practices actually work. So I would stay away from the pretense thing. And, you know, politically, my argument is very clear, you know, bring the Canadian troops home right now and disengage with U.S. foreign policy.
Yeah, I guess I will just quickly add to that that I really appreciate your question and, you know, and helping us to look at that issue in some more depth. And because like Sunera mentioned at the beginning of her talk, I too find myself in my women's studies classes having to stand up and remind students that we are at war. I mean, it's just no longer even on their radar. It's become such a given and so, almost taken as banal that it's not, the urgency with which we need to be talking about it and teaching about it is, it slips by. The other quick point around that is, to tie it back to this Royal Commission report, the one that came out in 1970, one of the things that was really noteworthy for me was how many of the recommendations were around women, joining, having the right to join the Canadian forces. And you know, if they are in the armed forces, then they need to be, ranked equally, paid equally, and so on. So there was never any critique of militarism. And so this, to me, highlights very nicely, Sunera's point around, what kind of feminism. This is the difference between the liberal feminism and some of the more critical feminisms that we try to teach about.
First of all, let me repeat the thanks to Melinda for organizing this series of events, which are going to raise some very interesting discussion. And I would also like to thank all of the panelists for some really thought-provoking commentary on the state we are in at the moment, as well as some reflections on the history. The point I would like to make is about the difficulty of the topic we are trying to address. I mean, we are trying to talk about feminism, we are trying to talk about the women's movement, and we are also trying to talk in general about women and women's interests. And in all three cases, we are talking about not one type of women's movement or feminism or women in general, but we are talking about a heterogeneity of interests and heterogeneity of perspectives and so on. And obviously, some of the seeming differences, perhaps, among the views expressed here may be based partly on the fact that we are talking about a number of different things and very different interests and groups and so on. And I'm just wondering, Janine, whether we can think about the three Ds of the women's movement, as you have called it, the legitimization, disappearance, and what was the third one?
Disassembling. Disassembling.
Okay. Whether we can think about those in terms of applying only to some parts of the women's movement as opposed to others, because on the one hand, we see a delegitimization of sections of the women's movement or certain demands or potentials in the women's movement that might have appeared at some of the moments, as Sunira has mentioned, a potential for leadership by certain groups, a potential of a true alliance amongst Canadian women and so on around certain issues, which kind of disappeared as it was perhaps emerging. Certain people have recently pointed out that, and I'm talking specifically about Hester Eisenstein talking about the dangerous liaison between feminism and neoliberalism, and Nancy Fraser also repeating some of the same arguments recently and talking about a major co-optation of feminism into the ideals of neoliberalism, partly because some of the demands of feminism, especially liberal feminism, definitely had no contradiction to the kind of I guess prioritization by neoliberalism of freedom of women through labor force participation and so on. So I'm just wondering whether we can bring some of these different ideas together by saying, on the one hand, we are living at a moment where certain ideals of feminism, certain notions of women's liberation and so on, have become valorized, are put on a pedestal, and are being used both for neoliberalism and for the war. And yet, the women's movement as a movement that should serve the interests of women in general is also being undermined and compromised in the most serious ways possible at the same time. Simultaneously, these are going on at the same time. Yeah. So I would just like to hear from different panelists about whether we can see both of these things happening at the same
time. I mean, many parts to that question, Sadaf. I think that my perspective is that we never really stand outside of the history. We never stand outside of our moment. We never stand outside of the dominant discourses that we live in. And so that, you know, much of the critique of, say, the Royal Commission is very much the other side of of social liberalism. The gentleman was speaking before about, you know, trade unions and so on. There was a whole group of privileged vocabularies and privileged speakers, etc. So one of the issues that concerns me at this point is that, yes, there is a kind of a reciprocity between some strains of feminism and neoliberalism. My first point is, we can't stand outside of neoliberalism in a sense that it determines, in a way, our vocabularies, but it also determines our points of resistance about, you know, what we push back at is what's being pushed at us. And so these kinds of politics are really unpredictable, but we're iterated in a certain way. So yes, we're iterated in. Women as, you know, super women who can be executives and have children and bloody, bloody, blah. Well, the whole plan of neoliberalism to degender women but regender them to have kids and do all the housework and now also look after elderly parents isn't working, okay? And so one of the really interesting ways in which I just finished reading Esping Anderson's new book called The Unfinished Revolution. And the problem in Europe and the problem here is that there aren't enough children because women are trying to do the work and carry a work-life balance and so on. So one of the ways in which neoliberalism wants to respond to women is to provide them with ways in which they can have children and stay at home. So the whole context changes, and then I think also as well, the agility of critique also has to change. Did we go there somewhere? Did I miss your question? Is that I had something else in my mind, so definitely it just went. I just felt it go like that. So, at any rate. Yeah, go ahead.
Society is based on the notion of whose children we are talking about. Exactly. I mean, we are talking about the same states having a major moral crisis about immigrants flooding into the country, which also talks about not the right kind of women, not having enough children, and so on. So we need to always be aware of.
Absolutely, especially in the European case, that this drives for Euro women to have children. And Euro women to work to pay taxes precisely as an anti-immigrant project. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I think we have time for one more question if there's
a final question. Okay. Well, if not, and before we wrap up this very productive session on local and global social justice movements, I want to invite you all to the session tomorrow on the status of Métis, Inuit, First Nation, non-status women, which will be held in a different room, library building, tomorrow with Mary Simon, Ellen Gabriel, and moderated, it's a conversation moderated by Tracy Lindbergh, and then to our status of women 40 years on session with Jean Augustine and Charlotte Thibault. And then the keynote address by Donna Brazil. So please join us for those sessions, where I'm sure other issues and themes will come into play. But it's my pleasure to thank our four speakers who have, I think, offered, again, an extraordinary commentary on some of the issues, as some of the questions raised. Not all issues have been around local and global social justice issues have been raised. Not all of the kinds of substantive themes that and challenges that face us have been covered, but I think the four presenters, Janine Brody, Aziz Chowdhury, Gada Marous, and Sunira Tabani, gave us a good survey of some of the ones that we face.